are your writing skills? Have you thought about writing recently? Well, that's our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Good evening. I'm John Pierce, your host. And Neil Heaver is our engineer. And we're going to be speaking with a professor at Cedar Crest College. Her name is Allison Welford. She teaches writing, and she is a writer, which I guess, Allison, is almost a necessity, right?
I think so.
If you don't write, then you don't teach writing. Okay.
It helps.
All right. This is the very basic thing. So Allison studied English at the University of Virginia, and you said that you were brought up in Virginia,
but
not exactly right in Charlottesville.
No, I grew up in a rural community, a farming community in Tidewater, Virginia.
All right. And what attracted you to the University of Virginia particularly? It was in-state. Was it a good tuition?
My grandfather studied there.
Ah.
He received his undergraduate degree there.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Yes.
All right. What did he study?
English
as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So big tradition in your family of English. And then you received your MFA. Now, MFA is?
A Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing.
In Creative Writing from Queen's University of Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost into South Carolina, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you throw a stone, you're going to hit South Carolina.
Sure.
It's pretty close there. So, but you've lived 20 years in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And you've lived in Prague, Manchester, Barcelona, Paris, and may I say, she's fluent in Spanish. Bienvenida a nuestros micrófonos.
Gracias, John.
Oh, yeah, and her Spanish is from Spain. And she lives in Allentown, where she is assistant professor of writing and, get this one, Pan-European MFA program director in creative writing at Cedar Crest College.
Yes, that's right.
Can you repeat that without looking at notes? Your whole title?
Yes.
That is a challenge. Listen. So I want to ask you about pan-European, or say across
mm-hmm.
Europe.
Sure.
Why do you put that in the title? Did you create this title, by the way?
I did not create the title, but I've been with the program since the beginning. It launched in 2013. Our first residency was in Dublin, Ireland, on Trinity College campus. And we rotate between different cities in Europe. So that's the idea of the pan-European. When, you know, other MFA programs or low residency programs focus on one particular city. For example, I think NYU has a residency in Paris. But we like to move around and to see different cultures and, mm-hmm. and visit different places.
And low residency means not for very long?
No.
What is low residency?
Low residency means, well, we'll talk about this a bit later in the program, but the difference between a residency and a low residency is a residency requires that you live in that city and study there. So, for example, if you wanted to study at the University of Iowa, which is sort of the Harvard of creative writing, you would need to live in Iowa City for 2 years. And a low residency is really suited for people who have families, have jobs, who don't have the flexibility to move to a new city just to complete graduate work.
All right. So low residency is a new term for me, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the University of Iowa.
Right.
Because in this part of the country, we don't name it very much.
Right.
But you say that it is very, very strong
mm-hmm.
in it's particularly creative writing or all kinds of writing?
Creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the oldest and most prestigious graduate program for creative writing.
Now, Allison Welford has published the novel Indolence, which is set in France. And you lived in Paris?
Yes.
For how long?
About 6 months.
Okay. And wrote this screenplay adaptation that has been optioned for film.
Right.
So tell us about that process. How do you get the word out that you have a novel that could turn into a screenplay?
Well, what I did, the novel itself really lends itself to screen because it's a linear narrative, it's a single narrative, and it's also very cinematic. One of the themes of the novel is it's set in the south of France, in the Midi-Pyrénées region of France, which is near Toulouse, And it's really about, it's very painterly. And so it lends itself to a cinematographic kind of aesthetic.
Would you have to shoot the film over there?
Yes.
Yeah, you don't go to Hollywood and make it up.
I mean, I would think so, because also it's in rural France, so it wouldn't be very expensive to shoot, right? The locations would be pretty easy to secure. It's optioned with a European production, so Hollywood wouldn't be involved at all. It would be a European film.
A European film.
Okay. Right.
And so it's called Indolence. So we're going to... Now, if I told our listeners, try to remember that name. Let's have our ear to the ground. if there's a film that we could see that's called Indolence, would it necessarily be the title of the film?
We'll see. I mean, it's far away from being made yet.
Yes.
Being optioned, many films are optioned and very few are made. So we'll see what happens.
But this is your first venture into this area.
Yes.
Okay. Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
I hope it turns into something really big. Alison Welford's work has appeared in the Gettysburg Review, the Barcelona Review, and Fence, among other journals, and nominated for a Pushcart Prize. That's a name I don't know.
The Pushcart Prize is an anthology that comes out once a year. judges select work from literary journals across the states, and they choose what they see are the best, the strongest works of fiction, and put them together for this anthology.
And you have received fellowships from Virginia Center for the Creative Arts and the McDowell Colony. Now, the McDowell Colony, I don't know either.
They're wonderful. They are,
where are they based?
Fantastic experiences. I really recommend writers applying for these fellowships at these writing residencies. They're amazing. So McDowell Colony is in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts is in Amherst, Virginia. And they're very difficult to get into. You know, usually, I'm guessing a little bit, let's say less than 3% of people who apply get in, so that it's very competitive. But when you get there, like the McDowell Colony, for example, you receive your own small cabin in the woods where you live.
Ooh.
And you receive a picnic basket in the daytime with your lunch, so you know, not to disturb your creative process as you are meant to write while you're there. And then for dinners, you have a social group of composers, visual artists, other writers, poets, fiction writers, playwrights, nonfiction writers.
And is this for a number of weeks during the
usually
summertime?
It depends. I mean, people can apply for 2 weeks up to 3 months.
And what was your particular... You went to both of these places, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts and the McDowell Colony. So describe for us each one of those. How long you were there?
I was at Virginia Center for the Creative Arts for 2 weeks in January of last year. It was cold, but it was fantastic because I got so much work done. You know, I wrote an entire chapter of the novel I'm working on now. I made a significant revision to a short story that I was working on within 2 weeks, which is not, I don't know if I would be quite so productive outside of that.
If you were at home.
Yeah, outside of that environment. It was so inspiring. Also to be around other people, you know, who are also being productive. So the energy is high and everyone is engaged and interesting, and we're having interesting conversations at dinner and you know, it's just really a fun environment.
That's great.
And the McDowell Colony I was there for a month, and it was in May of 2018. And it was fabulous. I met some amazing, amazing people. And the short story that will be published in Fence, which you've just mentioned, I wrote while I was there. I wrote two chapters of my novel. So I was productive. It was fun. It was a beautiful landscape. I've never spent much time in New England, and so that was really fascinating.
Wonderful. Yeah. Fun, productive, and beautiful.
Yes.
That's beautiful scenery, right?
Yeah, it was so inspiring. And there were a few mosquitoes, but other than that, it was perfect.
So it's creative writing that we're talking about this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm John Pierce. My guest is Allison Welford, who teaches writing at Cedar Crest College. She's talking to us about not only writing, but also places where she's lived. Allison, you set the novel Indolence in southern France, but you also lived in Prague, Barcelona, Manchester. Why did you choose southern France?
So I was visiting a friend in Gaillac, which is a town near about an hour away from Toulouse, and it was so rural. You know, when you think of the south of France, you think of the beaches of Saint-Tropez, you know, you think of gorgeous coastline and sort of decadent lifestyles.
Famous painters.
Yes, and famous yeah. painters. And this area was not touristy at all. And there were real people that lived there, people of the earth. And I loved how genuine they were, and I loved the lifestyle and being sort of that sort of kind of bucolic life that celebrated the things that they made, the things that they grew, and it was, I don't know, it was so inspiring, and the houses were so interesting. So
I wonder if any of that took you back to your roots, because you came from rural Virginia.
Yeah, I think I set a lot of my fiction in rural spaces, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a very familiar space for me. I think I'm a landscape junkie as well. I love describing landscapes for
and
pages.
If you were a painter, you would probably do landscapes.
So
right?
I do paint as well, but since I've come to Allentown and I've been teaching, I've put that on the back burner for a while. But I also do bring a sort of painter's sensibility to the page when I write.
And you just finished how many years at Cedar Crest?
4 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're working toward tenure?
I hope so.
You're on a tenure track?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
But that's okay.
We'll look at that in the future. So you have the novel Indolence set in France, and you also mentioned that you're working on another
yes.
novel at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a working title for that?
No.
Do you have, can you tell us anything about the storyline?
Sure, I can tell you a lot about the storyline.
Oh, good.
You know, I've had to write these applications for these fellowships, and I've thought about this a lot, and this novel means a lot to me, but I also want to be flexible in where it might take me. So for right now, you know, I can say my novel is an intimate portrait of familial and racial drama in 1970s and 80s Tidewater, Virginia. It's written from many different points of view. One of the points of view is an African-American female farmer who's competing against or with a community of white farmers as they work against the forces in Washington who advocate for ruinous ecological and economic policies, offering little protection for family farmers and their land. This is something I witnessed growing up in this community, this boom and bust agriculture. I think all of us sort of remember Farm Aid, perhaps, in the 80s. And sort of I'm sort of documenting the familial drama that's attached to the political drama.
Why was the farming boom and bust?
Why? Well, firstly, Nixon began trading with open international trade with China and then Russia. So we sold subsidized grain to Russia in the early 70s. Some people call this the Great Grain Robbery because we were, in a sense, subsidizing Russia. But what happened was we sold most of our reserves, and the price of grain went up very high. And the Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, told the population to plant fence row to fence row and to go big or get out. And so we saw a huge increase in land holdings by small farmers. So farmers bought land, bought big machinery, which was, we saw new technology in farm machinery at the time, and which meant a lot of loans, right? A lot of interest rates were quite low at the time. The price of grain was the highest that anyone had seen, and everything looked amazing. And so many people sort of plowed down their grandparents' house to plant corn, you know, and this not just in Iowa, but also in Virginia. And but what happened, like most bubbles, of course, the bubble burst. The interest rates went up. There was the reserve, the supplies grew, and so there was too much grain. We didn't know what to do with it. Later in the 80s, Jimmy Carter, who in Europe they think very fondly of, but to the U.S. farmer, there are a lot of ambivalent feelings because he there was an embargo, a grain embargo, so he didn't want to support the Cold War by selling grain. And, of course, that drove the prices down. And so the prices essentially plummeted, and people could not pay their mortgages, and farms were foreclosed. And it was sort of the death of the family farmer. Also, it was a moment in which the chemical conglomerates sort of grew in incredible with power. It was post-DDT. So after DDT, the farmers still use dangerous pesticides like organophosphates and carbamates without enough regulation. And so this kind of paved the way to what we see now as the monopoly that Monsanto has over the farmer. So it began this sort of slippery slope where the family farmer lost power in the market, and essentially everything changed.
It sounds ironic that President Carter would have been involved in that. He was a farmer himself.
I know.
So, interesting history.
Yeah.
I want young aspiring writers out there to take note that Alison Welford, the author and professor to whom you are listening right now, is very well versed in the rural aspects of our life, rural life in the U.S., also in France, which she's written a novel about. And my point is that sometimes you might think, all I want to do is write. I love words. But you have to have something to write about. Is it true?
It helps.
Otherwise, you're kind of talking to yourself.
So. Well, journaling can be incredibly therapeutic. I think journaling is a powerful tool that, you know, that
often used by therapists with their patients.
Sure, but yes. Anyone, you know.
Anyone to do journaling. Mm-hmm. Do you personally do journaling?
I used to.
As a professor?
I used to, right. But I now channel most of my energy into my large projects that are very time consuming.
Right. Well, Alison, it's time for us to take a break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. I'm John Pierce. We're going to hear an important message now, and stay with us. We'll be right back.
WDIY is celebrating our birthday, and you're invited to the party. Join us for a night of live music, food, drinks, and fun to mark WDIY's 24 years in the Lehigh Valley. Featuring a performance from the Large Flowerheads, paying tribute to the best music of the 1960s. Saturday, March 2nd, at the Ice House in Bethlehem. Get your tickets today at wdiy.org. We'll see you there.
Alison Welford is my guest on Lehigh Valley Discourse. She is the director of the Low Residency Pan-European MFA in Creative Writing. And from their website, it says, we'd like you to join us on a creative journey as you work toward the completion of your master's degree and the creation of a publishable work of literature. So Cedar Crest College is into master's degrees, and this is not the only one. I think they have a program in nursing also.
Yes, they have other master's degrees.
Other master's mm-hmm. degrees. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Traditionally, the colleges here have been four-year liberal arts colleges only undergraduate.
Right.
But we're getting into some master's degrees mm-hmm. now.
Yeah, it's been around since 2013.
All right. Mm-hmm. And so it says here, study fiction, poetry, nonfiction. Uh-oh, the N-word is in there, nonfiction. Allison, do you ever go even near nonfiction?
I just recently published a hybrid essay, which is a mix of fiction and nonfiction. Genre blending or genre bending is very popular these days.
Oh.
And that's the article that, I mean, that's the work that will be published in Fence magazine coming this spring.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. And the title of the article?
The Women You Love.
The Women You Love. Mm-hmm. And so it's a combination of nonfiction and fiction.
Right. It's a collagist text.
I had a colleague at Muhlenberg College years ago taught history. And she said, speaking of this hybrid kind of thing, she said, I cannot read a so-called historical novel because I have to be thinking that facts are facts. And I don't want them putting in a sister for Napoleon that he didn't have, for instance, in his writing. What would you say about that?
Facts actually change, right? Universal truth is one of the one permanent thing, you know, one permanent thing that we can look at. Poetic truth is constant, but facts change quite frequently if we look over time. You know, look at science, look at the history of science, the way certain things, the way we look at the world, the way facts are constantly changing.
Yeah, we used to think that everything revolved around the Earth.
And sure, we have the geocentric versus the heliocentric model. We have all these, So I don't know. I mean, perhaps and perhaps not.
right. Well, you're at least dabbling in that. Is that your first effort at a hybrid?
Yes.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. Now you do travel writing. Also, that's different. Mm-hmm. That's nonfiction.
So we offer travel writing at Cedar Crest College's MFA program because it's, like you said, that long-named pan-European program. Travel is integral. Travel is an essential part of the program. So it seems to make sense to celebrate travel in some way. Right, and because we are traveling, we're going to Dublin, Barcelona, and Vienna every summer, and traveling is so inspiring. It made sense to offer that.
Absolutely, I've always said that for an undergraduate student to spend a semester or two somewhere outside of the campus.
Yeah,
it could be Harrisburg, it could be Washington, D.C., it could be abroad.
Mm-hmm.
As you were an undergraduate, did you have a junior year abroad or some such?
My freshman year, I went to Oxford. And I did.
Freshman year?
It was my second semester.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That's unusual, that early in your studies.
I was excited to travel early
so
on.
So you pushed it.
I did. Well, I saw the opportunity, and I went for it.
Oh. Interesting. So travel writing is in there, and I agree with you on travel. There's just nothing. It gets your geography more solid, and you learn so much about not only the way other people live and think, but how you do yourself and your own language when you're dealing with other languages.
Sure. And to look at one's culture from another point of view is important. To look at America as a country outside of the bubble, so to speak, is really helpful.
Right. We talk about the bubble around Washington, D.C., but we could also say bubble wherever you might live.
Sure.
Getting out of your cocoon,
as
I call it. Award-winning faculty members in inspiring locations across Europe. And we've talked about that, this pan-European aspect. So when you're teaching travel writing, let's talk about that for a minute. How do you teach that? How can you help a person to get better at writing about travel?
Well, I haven't taught travel writing, but our faculty members do. And one of the seminars that we, like many of our seminars that we offer in the master's program, are craft-based. So we look at models of travel writing, published acclaimed works. And in the course would be taught by an award-winning writer in that field. And we examine through close reading how this writer achieve this? You know, some people say that all writing is kind of a form of travel writing in a way, as long as you sort of leave the confines of what we know as home, right? But it's not different from studying fiction, poetry, or creative nonfiction, except that we're doing that traveling while we're there at the residencies, and so the students can sort of engage with their environment in ways that, you know, would be different than, for example, at another MFA program that has only a residency, for example.
When you're teaching creative writing, how much can you really teach a person, and how much is it within the person that you're trying to draw? Maybe it's just always that you're trying to draw it out, that it's in the person. I'm thinking of the contrast between expository writing. We've all had classes through the years, and where the teacher would say, you must have a topic, and you must present an intro, and then the body, and then the conclusion, and be logical about it. That's expository writing. Mm-hmm.
Call it the hamburger.
Is that called the hamburger?
You have like the introduction.
That's good.
Supporting arguments and conclusions.
Yes, all right. And it could be with or without cheese, I suppose.
Yeah, cheese helps. Yeah. Cheese is always a little cheese in there.
A little fromage if you're up for it. So it seems to me that's an easier thing to teach, to grab a hold of.
Absolutely. It's linear.
And then, so what do you do with creative writing? How do you teach creative writing?
Well, that's a big question.
That's a huge question. Yeah, it is.
You should join our MFA program, and we'll show you how it works.
It would take time, yes. Class sure. after class after class, sure. making some progress.
I mean, practice is essential. But, of course, I mean, I think that's a question people had asked in the past, can you teach creative writing? And I say absolutely. You know, being someone that graduated from an MFA program, I took so many creative writing classes. I mean, I think I might have arrived at similar conclusions on my own through practice, but it would have taken so much longer, decades maybe.
That's an interesting point.
And so if you go to these workshops, and workshops are the sort of cornerstones for writing pedagogy. So, you know, basically, writers need feedback. Writers need to engage with their audience in some way. It's a very solitary experience, you know, and you're on your own. And there's so many things that you can't see, because I won't lie, writing is hard. You know, there's nothing easy about it. And so these workshops help to show you things about yourself and your writing that you can't know without external sort of influence. And so that's the sort of model that we use primarily in a creative writing class with regard to the work that's being produced. At the master's level, you know, you have to apply, you have to get in. I mean, we're looking for raw talent, we're looking for passion, we're looking for people who have things to say. And so that all that should be apparent. So we don't really need to teach them what to say, more how to shape their story, how to also what story is or what, you know, what language is. And so we approach the writing from many different angles in order to bring it to its best state toward with the idea of moving it toward publication.
I've heard the expression, write about what you know.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously in your case, it's rural life.
Sure.
That has been a big influence for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that simply a general statement that you would tell anybody who wants to write?
Well, I completely disagree with it. I think writing about what you know can be more dangerous than writing about what you don't.
Oh.
Right now I'm writing a novel, you know, set in rural Virginia, the one that I'm working on now, the agricultural novel. And I think it's actually quite dangerous to write about a place where you grew up and that you know so well, because you make mistakes, right? You assume other people know things that you take for granted.
But your reader doesn't know that you're making these mistakes.
The reader might do.
Oh.
You know, the reader might, because you might gloss over something that seems very obvious and given to you, but the reader might need as contextual clues, or you're just too familiar with it. You can't achieve distance. So actually, you know, in some ways, not knowing about a place, coming to it as a foreigner, coming to it as someone from an outside space and looking at it with fresh new eyes can be much more rewarding or interesting, or it can yield incredible results.
And when you chose southern France for your novel Indolence, mm-hmm. which, by the way, we mentioned could possibly be turned into a European film. We have to keep our ear to the ground on that one. You actually visited southern France.
Sure.
So you were there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But you were based in Paris more, or was it Barcelona at that
point? I was
in
Barcelona at that time.
Okay. I found out recently, and I never knew this because I'm a Francophile, and I really my roots there are not so much Paris as the east of France, Besançon, mm-hmm. in that area near Switzerland and Germany. And so I didn't have a good grasp of southern France. And when we traveled and went to Toulouse and I asked somebody, well, how would you go on the train from here to Paris? The person really hesitated and said, we'd be more likely to go to Barcelona than to Paris and cross the...
Sure.
You know, cross over into Spain.
It's still a tricky journey. I've done it by train. It's not completely straightforward. From Toulouse, you would need to go to Montpellier, and then from Montpellier to Barcelona. You'd have to change trains. So
to go there.
Yeah.
Right. So my point is, you were based in Paris. Why did you decide to go to southern France for a while?
So I was visiting my friend. It was a summer holiday, you know, and visiting my friend, and I recreated his family's house. That's in my novel, the main character, Maria, she is living with her American expatriate parents. Well, she's just returned from boarding school in the summer and where her parents live. And I was so in love with that landscape that I recreated that space. I didn't know anything really about France at all. I barely spoke French. My French is terrible. You know, I'm a fluent Spanish speaker, but in a way it was, writing the novel was a means for me to understand France, to get to know the culture and to get to know the place.
Interesting.
So I love conducting, I love research. I love researching for my fiction. So I find it gives me such a sense of sort of meaning and purpose. It becomes sort of who I am. I'm on a mission. I'm going to learn everything, and everything gets filtered into the novel. It's really fun, actually.
Well, now, you were visiting a friend. Mm-hmm. Did you bounce ideas for your novel off of the friend and ask, does this sound like life here?
No, but I did say, do you mind that I'm writing about your house? Do you mind?
Did she say, as long as you don't give our address?
Yes, basically. The house name is in the book, Verscal, but I changed it from the original name by a few letters.
Well, I'd be honored if somebody said, could I write about your house, as long as the person doesn't turn it into a Stephen King horror
yeah, exactly.
stuff, you know? Now, another question along this line of your experience in a place to write about the place. And you said, you don't necessarily have to write about what you know.
Mm-hmm.
Would you write a story about Detroit, Michigan? Mm-hmm. Not having been there?
Probably not, no.
No.
But I'm just, you know, I would need to be pursuing a particular idea that it's inspiring to me.
And have a specific reason for wanting
right.
to set it in Detroit if you did that.
Mm-hmm.
So, Allison, we want to hear a little bit of your writing.
Sure.
And so can you go to a passage, would it be from Indolence or is it
yes.
something else?
Okay.
From Indolence. And by the way, she has a copy of it right here. Indolence, a novel, Allison Welford. And it's a paperback, and it is about 200 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So is that, why do people write 500 and 600 page novels? That's too long.
I hope the novel I'm working on now doesn't reach that kind of length. What I'm writing now is sort of epic in proportion, with many different characters and many different points of view. And you know, you sort of want to complete the storyline of all the characters that you've introduced. And so that it just kind of happens.
I see, yeah.
Without one realizing.
Okay. All right. So give us a little sample from the novel Indolence.
Well, I thought I could just read the first 2.5 pages. Okay, this is from Indolence. Maria, fair of face, full of impish grace. I'm headed north on the train. The Mediterranean passes by the window. I'm sitting at one of the cafe car tables, my legs crossed, my arms crossed, my suitcase at my feet. The steam of my coffee uncoils like a thread into the air, a rope I wish I could climb away. At a far table, a little girl sits in her mother's lap as the mother braids her hair. A small group of tourists huddle together and pose for photos. Others queue for their coffees, tiny cans of soda, and plastic-wrapped baguettes. I bring my coffee to my lips, but it's too bitter to drink. I'm going home. My father will be washing the sheets, combing the market for vegetables and wine, talking to the locals about the weather in his sweet, hackneyed American French. Oui, il fait beau, beau temps d'hiver, not able to understand their replies. But I forget, of course, his French must be better now. It's been years he's searched for me. The station announcement crackles over the speakers. I could get off here, or the next stop, or the next. I scramble in a sudden panic through my pocketbook for my passport and wallet, lay my finger on the smooth faux leather. I'm doing this every half an hour or so. I return to my seat, lean back, and shut my eyes. I can't remember the last time I slept properly, each night full of nightmares that I immediately forget upon waking, only the fear remaining. If the fear had a name, it would be his. Omar of Rabat, Omar of the Tarn, murderous Omar, amorous Omar, Omar by the swimming pool. My scalp tightens. I keep my eyes closed. I've always been an insomniac. As a child, my insomnia allowed me the exquisite pleasure of slipping into my parents' big four-poster bed at night. Squeeze all the muscles in your legs and arms tight as you can, my father said. I tensed my muscles and gritted my teeth. Now let go. Feel your body relax. But I couldn't relax. The squeezing made me more excited, and I'd roll onto my side, my stomach. I would nuzzle into their backs and arms, so happy to be there. My father was a physical man. He had been an all-American soccer player and reduced everything to the body. If I was sad, it was because I didn't get enough exercise. If I was bored or tired or had bad grades, it had to do with the body's discipline. Not enough stretching, not enough the vitamins that came in hard, dry pellets that I was loath to chew. I had to jump, to bend, to sprint my way toward balance. And don't forget, posture was of utmost importance. One could not perform in any manner without perfect posture.
Thank you, Alison Welford, from her novel, Indolence. It's time for us to take another break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
So we've just heard Alison Welford read the beginning of her novel, Indolence, which is a little taste that I think should whet our appetite to try to get a copy of the novel. I guess go to the usual sources, which is internet and
sure.
Amazon and
mm-hmm.
Barnes & Noble and whatnot.
Exactly.
And it's the novel called Indolence. What year published?
2014.
Mm-hmm. And it's about 200 pages, small pages too. But the one thing that I picked up on, Alison, as you were reading, was the attention to detail.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's just a very basic thing for writers, but instead of saying flowers, you see that there are zinnias
right.
or tulips
right.
and so on.
Being specific is
yes,
important.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Raising the coffee cup to the lips, but the coffee was too bitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I really like that.
Yeah,
that kind
details,
of detail.
Details slow things down. which creates drama. That's a sort of technique for writing.
Mm-hmm. Right. The Cedar Crest College Pan-European Creative Writing MFA program, in which Allison Welford directs, offers gifted students from around the world a unique opportunity to unite for three 15-day intensive workshops held in European locations rich in culture and literary significance. And they are Dublin, Vienna,
and Barcelona.
And Barcelona.
Mm-hmm. Where I lived for 15 years.
Oh, 15 years in Barcelona.
Yeah.
All right. So you say Barcelona.
No.
is that a reaction against the Spaniards?
Yes. Well, in Catalonia, you don't. In Catalan, you wouldn't say Barcelona because no. That's the Castilian Spanish.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So they do say Barcelona.
Yes, if you're Good. Catalan.
I'm glad to know that because my Spanish comes from Latin America and we don't do that. The remainder of your studies will take place on your time and in your home, led by faculty members and supported by an international community of students. So our privilege today is to have Allison Welford here, who directs this program at Cedar Crest College. Allison, tell us what's distinct about this? What's unique about this program?
So our low residencies are incredible. You know, we offer craft-based, genre-specific writing workshops and craft seminars with local writers and scholars, which is really unique and interesting. We like to integrate our students with the community of writers in that space, and it's so inspiring.
Yes? When you are this MFA program that you direct, do the students go to Cedar Crest campus, or is this distance learning?
They can if they want. So it's 2-week residencies in the summer, the first 2 weeks of July, but then they can. Then the rest of the year is distance mentorships. But we also have online seminars for students to keep them engaged. We have visiting writers on campus, students can visit the college campus. One of the things, and I've done some research, and I haven't been able to find any other program that offers their students, low residency program, MFA program, that offers their students teaching internships, which we do. So if the student is within, sort of commuting distance, they can gain teaching experience.
Commuting distance to Cedar Crest College.
Right.
Right here in Allentown. Mm-hmm. If we have listeners who are interested to find out more information about this, they could always go to the Cedar Crest College website. Mm-hmm. But is there another number or email address or something?
They would email me.
Okay. And that would be?
ACWELLFO. @cedarcrest.edu.
Okay, we'll try to remember to do that again at the end of our hour. So you have students from all over. You probably have all age students too.
Exactly, we have students from the ages of 23 to 75. I think, and they're from all over the world. You know, many are from North America, but we have students in Paris and in Saudi Arabia and. We have a student, I'm trying to remember where everyone is. Okay. They're all over the world and all ages.
Many of them you would not meet at all?
Well, what's so interesting is it's such an international community. And that makes it much more unique than, say, a residential program that doesn't travel, that doesn't expand like that. And so, we also engage with local scholars and professors at, for example, in Barcelona, we had a local poet and professors from the University of Barcelona give lectures. In Dublin, we have a Joyce scholar talk about Joyce's work, or an Irish poet talk about the use of myth in poetry. You know, very inspiring, interesting events. We attend readings outside of our group.
And what you're talking about right now is taking students from the Lehigh Valley to these different cities,
right?
Which is fascinating. But you're also talking about students who are distance learners, and they are in place, and they're not traveling with you. Right. So it's two different populations.
No, it's the same students. All students have to attend the residencies and then during the year they work one-on-one with a mentor.
Oh, all right. So during the residencies, then you do get to know somebody
exactly.
who might be
oh,
in
yes.
Africa or
yes, exactly.
Eastern Europe
yes.
or whatnot. Do you have anybody participating from China or from Russia?
No.
I just wonder if that's a political thing in those countries or if it's just it hasn't happened yet.
I have a student in the States who is of Russian descent who wants to work as a literary translator from Russian to English, but she doesn't currently live in Russia. No.
Right. What else should we know about the MFA program in creative writing?
Well, I like to say we're the first sort of pan-European program. We are the first graduate-level writer program offered by an American college that includes residencies that take place exclusively in Europe. Our faculty are amazing. We have award-winning, internationally acclaimed faculty members. They're from all over the world, from Trinidad, New Zealand, Bosnia, Wales, the USA, India. They've won their National Book Award finalists, Guggenheim Fellows. We have a poet laureate of the poet laureate of Wales. I mean, we have amazing, wow. amazing faculty members. One of the yeah. advantages of having faculty members like this in this low residency program is that, or what one of the advantages of being a low residency is, you know, not all of these acclaimed, brilliant writers want to sign up as a tenure track position at a residential program. And so this gives them the flexibility that they want and access to teaching, which is really, really fun. I mean, as right. a teacher myself. But also it creates this interesting international community where we have such a low faculty student ratio. It's amazing. And these residencies are fun. Students really get to know their faculty mentors. We go to dinners together. We take trips together and excursions. We go to the theater together. So it's, you know, that distance is minimalized and students make contacts with their faculty mentors that help them work toward publication. If you have an advocate who's a professional, a published professional, that is something that can help you towards succeeding with your work.
Now, is the contact between these very well-known writers, I mean, the Poet Laureate of Wales, for instance, mm-hmm. would that be a lecture that person gives and that we see on a screen?
Oh, no, that would be the student's one-on-one mentorship.
So, oh, my goodness.
So she or he would work one-on-one with that.
But would that be in Wales or would that be on the Cedar Crest College
That would
campus?
Be during at the residencies that we host, so Dublin, Barcelona, or Vienna, and then the one-on-one mentorship, distance mentorships that happen online over the year.
All right, so famous writers actually travel to where you
mm-hmm.
are
yeah.
to participate with the students.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a great opportunity for our students. Yeah.
Something that you wish had been there when you were
yes,
a student?
Yes. Well, this is partially my idea, this program. You know, I was a student in 2008, and I thought, I want to start a low-residency MFA in Europe. Why does one not exist? And so here we are.
Here we are. Good for you. How does – let's suppose we have a listener who is interested in the MFA
mm-hmm.
and just – interested in writing, and we're talking now about novels, short stories, fiction.
Right.
How would such a person start to be noticed and get published?
Sure. It's a different sort of path for each genre. So poetry is very different from nonfiction, from, say, travel writing, which is a kind of nonfiction, but also can lend itself more towards journalism. And fiction. I mean, I can tell you very specifically about my experience with publishing my novel. You know, my novel was part of my MFA thesis. So, you know, just like a PhD program, a student has to create a thesis at the end, something that is like a manuscript that would be published if the student wanted. Anyway, so I workshopped my manuscript and I had my thesis committee give comments, and I revised my manuscript, and then I sent it to agents. There's a pretty systematic approach towards publication. There's not a lot of mystery. I mean, the most important thing is having a really strong manuscript, a clean, strong manuscript, and having your first 25 to 50 pages be immaculate. You know, because really that's what agents are looking at first. When you go to query agents, that's what they're not asking for a full manuscript usually. They just want to see maybe even fewer pages, maybe even the first 15. So you want those first pages to be outstanding.
Right. Now, what distinguishes outstanding from mediocre? Is it typos?
No. Well, typos never help. No. Yeah. Typos should be avoided.
Amen.
I mean, you know, correct grammar and clean copy editing is important. That kind of immaculate writing is important. But really having a sense of character, a conflict evident early on, so that we know, the reader knows what they're getting into. So yes. A kind of hook should be apparent.
Yeah, the reader cares about what happens to these characters.
Exactly.
It comes down to that, doesn't it?
Right. And sometimes it could be stylistic. You know, it could be a kind of stylistic creative risk that's going on that's very engaging, or it could, like I said, be a conflict or character. There is no sort of prescribed, you know, format, which is good, because then that would be a kind of straitjacket, and then everyone would do it like a formula, right? So, I mean, we like that.
It would get very boring.
So what one would do is to send out work to an agent. So how do you find an agent, right? So Poets and Writers is a magazine. They have a database online, and it's an incredible resource for writers.
Poets and Writers.
Magazine.
You just put that into the computer.
Yep. I really recommend looking at, they have the residence, a list of residencies that we were talking about earlier, like Madal and Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and they have a database of agents. And in that database, you should look for agents that publish the genre in which you're writing. So, for example, if you're doing YA, young adult, you don't want to send to a literary fiction agent, right? You need to do your homework. Also, another way to find an agent that might be a good fit is to look at writers you admire, or look at writers with whom you have something in common, like either stylistically or thematically, and looking online, seeing who their agent is, you know, and contacting those agents. Usually there's a kind of formula. You need to create a query letter, which tends to be about 1 to 2 pages, a short bio, a kind of synopsis of the work without a spoiler. You want it to be a sort of hook. You want to really get their attention. And then you send usually a sample of that 25 pages. You have to look at each agency requires, has a different requirement about what they want you to send them. And then you wait and you cross your fingers and see what happens. Some people, and I really would like to recommend to listeners out there, is don't directly go to self-publishing. You know, try getting an agent, try a traditional publishing route first, before self-publishing, because self-publishing can be, you know, lucrative, but it also it doesn't have the same credential as actually publishing a book. If you already have, you know, so many thousands of Instagram followers, if you already have so many thousands of followers on Wattpad, these sort of open form places for writers, then perhaps self-publishing could be your ticket. But really, what's great about publishing with having an agent, having an editor, is not only sort of correcting your work and making your work as strong as possible, but also having that sort of force behind you to help promote your work. Because as a self-published work, you're the only person that cares, and you're the only person promoting it, unless you want to spend money to hire a promoter, and then that's a financial risk. So I really recommend MFAs are a great way to learn what happens in the industry. You make contacts. For example, our MFA program at Cedar Crest, we connect with different conferences that have like kind of speed dating with agents and editors, for example. We host seminars and introduce students to agents and editors. In Barcelona, my best friend is an editor at Random House, and she comes with a literary scout and two agents, and they have a talk with our students. So we like, and international publishing is also very interesting because many people focus only on New York, right? Everything, like New York is the center of the world, but there are people who publish in English outside of New York. And so I think there are many different avenues, and the MFA is a really great way to guide students in that process.
And let's remind people, if they would like to get in touch with you personally, what's the is it an email address?
My email address is acwellfo@cedarcrest.edu.
This is Allison Welford, and she is our guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Allison, I wanted to get back to this idea of you have to write about something. And I said off the air that there was a journalism teacher of mine back in high school who said, who was in journalism, and she said, when I graduated, all I wanted to do was, I think that was from Ohio State University, was to write. So I went to, and I got a job at a newspaper in Columbus, Ohio. And the very first thing that my bosses told me was, the first article you're going to write is on the sewage system in Columbus, because they're having problems with it. So go and find out all that you can about the sewage system.
Oh, fun.
And she said, see, that's the kind of research that you would enjoy. And she said, it just knocked me back a little bit, because I thought writing was going to be this ethereal kind of thing. And here I had to go study to be able to write about it.
Sure.
Now, from the webpage from Cedar Crest College, a book is simply the container of an idea, like a bottle. What is inside the book is what matters. That's from Angela Carter. The writer is an explorer. Every step is an advance into a new land. That's Ralph Waldo Emerson. And a word after a word after a word is power. That's Margaret Atwood. Well, it's time for us to wrap it up for Lehigh Valley Discourse for this week. Allison Welford is my guest. Thank you so much for coming over and visiting us.
Thank you so much, John.
This is the first time you've been to WDIY. Welcome.
Thank you.
And hope you can return. Until we meet again, dear listeners, remember to be gentle with your neighbor. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Neil Heaver for engineering. I'm John Pierce. Good evening.